I'm Bob Garfield, and this is the fourth and final installment of our summer series, Bob's Docs. Over the past month, we've revisited interviews with documentary filmmakers and considered the sins of manipulation, the primacy of access, and the sheer power of prurience. But this week, it's personal. The family connections that can imbue an inquiring filmmaker with a particular level of zeal. For our finale, we bring you the story behind Ken Dornstein's My Brother's Bomber, a film that may have helped to press the restart button on official investigations into the Lockerbie bombing. But first, recalling an iconic episode of American introspection, the murder of Kitty Genovese on a New York street in 1964. The crime dishonored the city, all cities, as the emblem of urban dehumanizations. The lead in the New York Times read, quote, "For more than half an hour, 38 respectable, law-abiding citizens in Queens watched a killer stalk and stab a woman in three separate attacks in Kew Gardens."
Tomorrow marks what many people regard as one of the most shameful anniversaries in New York City history.
50 years ago, her murder led to the adoption of the 911 system.
Police discovered that more than 30 people had witnessed her attack, and no one had picked up the phone to call the police.
Kitty's teenage brother, Bill, read the story and believes it made him the man he became. But is the story true? A 2015 documentary, The Witness, follows Bill's long and arduous pursuit of the witnesses to Kitty's death and her life, the so-called witnesses who shamed us all. James Solomon directed and produced The Witness. He spoke with Bob's Docs New York City Metro correspondent Brooke Gladstone last year.
So, the film's narrator, Kitty Genovese's brother, Bill Genovese, was 16 when she was murdered. The film is really about him, isn't it? You've called it a love story.
It is a love story. Bill was determined to reclaim his sister's life from her death. Kitty was, as he describes in the film, his mother and father combined. She heard him, listened to him, affirmed him, validated him, but it wasn't just the fact that he lost this sister who he adored so much, but the way she reportedly died. That story shaped the rest of his life.
You met him in the course of researching a feature film about Kitty Genovese. You are a script writer. Then you decided to make your own directorial debut by creating this documentary with Bill at the heart of it.
What I discovered was that I could not possibly do justice to the story of Kitty Genovese by writing it, that the people who could best tell the story of who she was and what happened that night were the people who actually lived it. Bill was determined to find out for himself what actually happened that night. And so for the past decade, Bill has been on this quest. Bill said to me, "I needed to not only prove that I would have been one of the people who opened the window that night, but I would have been one of the people who went down into the street."
Martin Ginsburg, who broke the story in the Times in 64, was working under the supervision, essentially, of New York Times editor Abe Rosenthal, who'd spoken to a police chief and later wrote 38 witnesses about the case and about the bystander syndrome, also known as the Genovese syndrome. The New York Times has since written stories revising that original account. What he seems to say is that the story may or may not be entirely true, but the syndrome that I identified that is now being taught in sociology classes is too important to mess with.
I can't swear to God that there were 38 people. Some people say there were more, some people say there were less. But what was true, people all over the world were affected by it. Did it do anything? You bet your eye it did something, and I'm glad it did.
Journalists, as you know, have this saying, some stories are too good to check. And it appears that this may be one of those kinds of stories where the story of 38 having watched for more than a half hour simply just wasn't true. How many watched? How many heard? Did anyone call? And how did that story come to be? Bill would have to jump back 52 years to get the answer to that by tracking down the journalists who covered it.
One of whom is Mike Wallace.
No one investigated the 38. No one followed up on it or anything of that nature.
Do you have any feel for why that would have been with this case versus any other case?
Because it was taken seriously by the New York Times.
He did manage to track these people down by cross-referencing essentially illegible police records with transcripts of the original police interviews that he got hold of from a reporter. Probably the most important witness he finds is a neighbor of Kitty's and a friend named Sophie Farrar.
Well, think about it. For a half century, your entire family lives off the understanding that your daughter, your sister, died alone. And then you find out, well, actually, she died in the arms of a friend.
Kills me when I think about it. Black leather gloves and all cuts all through the gloves on her both hands. I only hope that she knew it was me, that she wasn't alone.
It makes you question the narratives that shape your life and the way false narratives change the course of your life. Bill's life propelled by a false narrative.
In the film, there's a suggestion that Bill Genovese enlisted in the Marines and went to Vietnam in part as a response to Kitty's murder because he didn't want to be an apathetic bystander to the war in the same way that those witnesses supposedly were to her death. But do you think he really would have acted differently had he known the real story?
Well, Bill answers that question in a variety of ways. He definitely felt that he needed to prove that he was not like those people that night. Even when he was in Vietnam, he was the one who'd raise his hand for every dangerous mission. He's also told me that had Kitty lived, she would have talked him out of going to Vietnam.
One thing that we see is that he is indomitably independent. He's certainly bucking his family, striving against many odds to get to the truth of this story, and he does it without his legs. He travels either in a wheelchair or he gets off the wheelchair and he just basically slides across the room. He is unselfconscious about that. And yet it seems almost like a visual metaphor in a way for the damage he sustained.
The people who appear in the film, the witnesses who were there that night in particular, it is only because of Bill's understanding, in a sense, of trauma that I think a lot of the people were willing to open up. This is not the selfie generation that are talking. Because they owed it to Kitty, because Bill is extraordinarily empathic as a person, and also because he's walked the walk, people were willing to open up to him. And so what unravels over the course of the film is a level of insight into what happened that night, the effect of it, that I don't think anyone else could have possibly brought out.
Among the people Bill spoke to was the murderer's son, a man named Stephen Mosley, a former prison guard who later became a preacher. You draw an interesting parallel between the two.
They're two men who are stepping outside the comfort zone of their family. They are determined to meet each other for different reasons, but against the desires of their family. And they both are holding on to narratives that in the course of their conversation are challenged.
Let me just say this here. I was kind of apprehensive about talking to you. From what I've understood, there was a Genovese crime family. Are you related to the crime family of the Genovese?
No, not at all.
I've always been told that it had been the crime family that
Truthfully,
Kitty was from.
Stephen, between you and me, it's not true.
Everybody in my family says to me, you know, you're crazy. You shouldn't go there. You may not come back.
So you're not only cordial for coming here, but you're courageous for coming here.
Winston Mosley's family and Kitty Genovese's family has been holding to these stories that on closer examination may not be true.
Bill talks about the moment in Vietnam when his legs were off and he thought he would bleed out, and he projected himself back to what he imagined his sister had gone through.
The closest Bill ever got to experiencing what it was like for his sister that night occurred in July of 1967 when Bill was on patrol and a remote-controlled detonated landmine blew up and he was thrown into the rice paddy, waiting and hoping for someone to come to his aid and finding himself all alone. And he has said that that was the first time in Vietnam he thought of his sister.
Particularly tragic on top of all of this tragedy, Kitty's nieces and nephews, who she'd never met, didn't know who she was. For one of them, her name came up in class in high school. She didn't even realize it was her own aunt.
That is one of the great tragedies. The account of her death was so public and so horrific that it erased her life within her own family. Bill's brother, Vin, in the film, refers to the only way we could deal with her death was to not talk about her life.
You know, I often wondered how much detail Billy would get into. So-and-so did this, so-and-so opened the window, so-and-so shouted, so-and-so. For what? She's dead. She's murdered. You know, I don't want, why do I want to hear that?
What Bill does is to reclaim his sister's life from her death. Kitty was a remarkably fascinating and compelling figure, 28-year-old woman working in a bar, managing the bar.
A live wire in high school who never had any grand intellectual ambitions. She just seemed to want to be free.
We played hooky. We went to the beach. Or here in the park, or smoking on the roof. And she was the head of the pack.
Yeah, she's driving a red Fiat, living with a woman, Marianne, and what Bill does in the film is reveal a person that we all would feel, gosh, I really wish I knew her.
Bill didn't even know she was gay.
He did not. Really, the greatest sadness is for Marianne, who was Kitty's lover. They were living in Kew Gardens, and after she died, the family didn't know, and there was no connection between the family and Marianne until this film. There's a very poignant moment. Bill and Marianne are speaking for the first time in virtually a half century, and Marianne says to Bill, I just wish I could have done something. And Bill says, yeah, I know. Me too, essentially.
Now for the controversial last scene. He, you, hire an actress simply to scream. We meet the actress. There's no effort to make this be a recreation in a History Channel or Discovery Channel sense of the word at all. He wants to hear screaming in that space. We see him putting up signs to the neighbors to be aware and not to worry. It is nevertheless horrifying. I wonder if you aren't going to come in for some criticism for how horrifying it is.
The film documents Bill's 11-year journey, and at the end of that journey, Bill had this desire and this need to immerse himself in what took place that night. He had been talking and thinking about what it was like. And with the limitations of a half century, you can't recreate exactly what it was like. But the street stands like a movie set. Austin Street is just the way it was, virtually, as it was 1964. And so on a night on April 1st, 2014, on a night not so dissimilar to the night that his sister was murdered, was able to feel what it was like.
Did you know how this story would end when you began?
Brooke, you know you knew my brother very well. My brother John was a contributor to this show and became a good friend of this show. And you and this show is a huge place in my heart. In 2004, I was making a film about a brother who lost a sister. I had no personal understanding of that kind of loss. Along the way in making this film, my own brother John, the person who I looked up to more than anyone in the world, got sick with leukemia and died a couple years later. So what was once an abstract understanding of sibling loss ceased to be. And so, no, I had no idea what the feeling or experience or the importance of this film would be like for me. We followed Bill, and I had no idea as to where it would take us. I think Bill and I thought it would take 6 months, a year, never thought it would take 11 years. And his family now knows who Kitty the person was, not just Kitty the victim. Over a half century, this man is determined to reclaim his sister, her life, from her death. It's, in my estimation, the ultimate love story.
James, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brooke, so much for having me on the media.
James Solomon is the director of The Witness, coming out in selected theaters June 3rd.
When James Solomon's brother passed away, the decade he spent documenting Bill Genovese took on a new personal angle. When filmmaker Ken Dornstein's brother died, along with 269 others, in the 1988 Lockerbie airplane bombing, a series of investigations began that for decades would remain inconclusive. This is David Mulholland, a Scottish investigator, speaking in 2011.
And I've been working hard in the background with U.S. law enforcement and with my Crown Office colleagues, in particular Lindsay Miller and her team, to try and put the Lockerbie investigation way back at the top of the radar. It still is the biggest act of terrorism in UK British soil.
All 259 souls on the flight were killed, along with 11 residents of Lockerbie, Scotland, where debris from the plane left a miles-wide field of wreckage. Only one person, a Libyan man named Abdel Besid al-Megrahi, was convicted and jailed for the bombing, but he was granted compassionate release because he was dying of cancer. 3 months to live turned into 3 years, and he died in 2012. Justice, it seemed, died with him, but not inquiry.
It's been 25 years since the terrorist bombing over Lockerbie, Scotland, and now U.S. and Scottish authorities are trying to interview two newly identified suspects. The 1988 bombing of the Pan Am jetliner killed 270 people. Family members welcome the news about the new suspect.
Ken Dornstein has spent years trying to locate other figures from Muammar Gaddafi's security apparatus connected to the bombing. 27 years after the crime, his three-part series on PBS's Frontline, called My Brother's Bomber, reveals new information about a Libyan explosives expert, as well as other possible suspects. Just days after his documentary aired, came the news that two of the men he reported on, Gaddafi-era spy chief Abu Sanusi and Libyan explosives expert Abu Aghila Massoud, would be pursued as suspects. Dornstein does not think it's coincidence.
And I do know that in the middle of that reporting, the U.S. government did become aware of some new leads that I had developed. While I can't for sure connect the dots, I think it would be a very unlikely coincidence if the evidence that we had developed as part of this series hadn't in some pretty substantial way been baked into the news that we heard this week officially.
Tell me about your reporting, what you had in mind when you got started.
You know, there was a docudrama made very early on in the first year or so after the bombing. And it was done by a British television outfit. And I remember seeing it when I was 20 or 21. And there was a very vivid scene of someone parting some beaded curtains. And there was a bomb maker in there at his workshop. And he's connecting wires. It planted in my mind a kind of a fantasy that there were places where these people worked and lived. And that you could, if you were clever enough, find them and confront them, though I didn't really begin the reporting that became this film until 2011, I did have a naive idea about doing something like this, dating all the way back. I had this list of names. They'd been pulled from the files of the original investigation, and I thought one of them would open the door.
And in fact, let's listen to some tape of the retired Scottish investigator.
Every one of these, at some stage, played a part. And a surprise expert in charge, explosives in particular. A surprise mechanic, you could say, that started the ball rolling. He holds a key to it all. These are the people that must be found, and these are the people who are responsible. But they never, ever got access to them long enough to interview any of them.
So you go down this list, and one of them dies of prostate cancer, the only man convicted in the crime. Another is a key henchman of Muammar Gaddafi, who in the final days of his regime, Gaddafi assassinates. Others are murdered by militants in the chaos that came with the fall of the Gaddafi regime. Eventually, there's three people you isolate who are the keys to this story. And one is a black Libyan whom the Scottish investigator a moment ago referred to as the surprise man. Who is it?
I call him Abu Aguila, or it's Abu Aguila Massoud, or sometimes he's just called Massoud. When you pour through tens of thousands of pages of trial transcript and declassified documents, you don't see his name a lot, but you see it a few times. He's right next to the one guy who was convicted, Abdel Basset al-Megrahi, and he's right there at the moment, if the prosecution theory is right, when that bomb was inserted into the luggage system and forwarded on to Flight 103. So he's in the right place at the right time. They had his landing cards, and they had dusted them for fingerprints, and there was this passport number. That's who he was for me for years. He was a name and a passport number and a fingerprint. And so there's years of searching for someone I'm not even sure exists until I come across someone who actually admits they know him.
Aha. And this guy was himself your fantasy confessor. He had admitted his participation in a German discotheque bombing, also at the orders of the Gaddafi regime.
That's right. And in that disco bombing, which happened about 2+ years before the Lockerbie bombing, there was a Libyan who actually confessed to the German authorities. He said that there was a bomb expert who came in to help us, and that man's name was Abu Aguila Massoud. There was that name. And then when I went further into the evidence, there was that passport number, the same one that I'd seen on that landing card, and it confirmed for me that this mystery person traveling with al-Megrahi, the one man convicted, was himself a bomb expert, maybe a bomb maker. That was a kind of game-changing realization.
At this stage, I just want to remind our listeners that you have a very personal stake in all of this as the brother of one of the victims of the Lockerbie bombing. And this gets me to that third character who plays such a prominent role in your film. He's Swiss. He runs a small electronics firm that makes timing devices such as used in the Lockerbie bombing and was personally acquainted with all of the conspirators and was a long-term vendor to the Gaddafi regime. You spend a lot of time with him, most cordially. What was that experience like?
Edwin Bollier saw our encounter as a kind of a chess match. As a documentary filmmaker, if someone is willing to film, it means that there's something they want from the encounter. Sometimes I think the true subject of what we're talking about is not, are they telling you the truth? Are they lying to you? It's more, are they lying to themselves? Edwin Bollier doesn't talk about the Lockerbie bombing, the actual event that killed 270 people. Edwin Bollier talks about the Lockerbie affair, which in his mind is an elaborate plot to frame Megrahi, the Libyans, and himself for the bombing.
So you're saying it wasn't Libya?
Yes.
And it wasn't Abdel Basset al-Megrahi?
Yes.
And it wasn't your timer?
Yes.
And we don't know who fabricated
yes.
the evidence
yes.
against Libya
yes.
and you?
Yes.
We know nothing.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, true. When you see from this side, we know nothing.
Where am I emotionally? I think I'm trying to understand the psychology of somebody in his position, and I'm trying to confront him with bits of new evidence. And while the camera's running, I want to see how he reacts to it. Because even if someone doesn't intend to tell you the truth, if I wait long enough, maybe the truth will emerge anyway.
At one point in the film, it's explained to you that Libyans you speak to will just assume you're with CIA or with law enforcement. You were there as a documentarian. You were there as a storyteller. You're there as a victim who lost a family member. What were you finally in the making of My Brother's Bomber?
I see myself as a documentary filmmaker. The methods are journalistic methods. I wouldn't have made it through the frontline fact check. There was a New Yorker piece written about this. I wouldn't have made it through the New Yorker fact check. And that said, I wanted it to be watchable. I wanted it to be a story of one person going in search of answers that had eluded him, and turns out many other people, for 25 plus years. And then ultimately, the satisfactions that may be there at the end of the day if you can succeed.
Now, had you done this on assignment from Frontline, there's a number of things in this film that in no way would they have permitted. There are a number of people you spoke to from whom you withheld the central purpose of your questions. There was a scene where you went into the home of the dying al-Megrahi with a hidden camera that you were prepared to use to get him on tape without his knowledge in his deathbed. These are not kosher journalistic techniques. Tell me what the conversations were like with the executives at Frontline.
By the time, you know, it came to actual discussions with Frontline about what should or shouldn't be in the film, I think we had a sense of what I had done journalistically. The decisions themselves weren't made lightly. It's not good for someone who wants to be in the business of being a filmmaker, approaching people and saying, you need to trust me, and outing yourself as somebody who in certain situations films or records secretly. That's not a smart thing to do. It's not an ethical thing to do. There was the requisite hand-wringing on my part. And yet, I was confronted in certain situations with the idea that I was going to be in a room with someone, maybe for the only time ever, and they could potentially tell me something. I very much wanted people to see what I saw so that it couldn't be denied.
Does it help to be Ahab, monomaniacal?
There was a time, you know, Ahab was looking for the white whale, and I was looking for this man who we called the Black Libyan because his description was that he had very dark skin. That was his most salient feature. I think that in order for anybody to do any significant piece of original work, there has to be a certain degree of passion and maybe monomania to get you over the inertia and through the obstacles. I had worked for a long time with Frontline, who had a reputation for doing it. And at a moment where I was looking for my next thing professionally, the conditions suddenly emerged, which were really unthinkable even a year or so before that. The Gaddafi regime, after 42 years, would fall. There's a series of coincidences as well that I took advantage of.
And now finally, 27 years after the murders, are you finished?
I want to say reflexively, yes. Right now, it's in the hands of people who could advance it beyond what a filmmaker could do. I'm not finished with it in the sense that it marks you in a certain way, and it's bound up with who my brother was himself. And I'm sorry he's gone. And in some ways, having a project around him is a way of continuing a relationship with him. I won't let it go in the sense that I will stop thinking about the bombing, but yes, I'm done with it in the sense that the continuing invitations I have to go to a Libyan jail and come face to face with this man who I think is the bomb maker, I don't see myself taking any time soon.
Ken, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob, for having me.
Ken Dornstein's series for PBS's Frontline is My Brother's Bomber. He's also author of The Boy Who Fell Out of the Sky, a memoir about his brother and former OTM contributor John Solomon. And that concludes our summer series, Bob's Docs. A reminder that you can crack into our archives at any time at onthemedia.org. And if you want to peek into what our staff is reading, watching, and listening to, head on over to facebook.com/onthemedia. It's a treasure trove of smart stuff the producers are drawing from during the week to bring to you on the big weekly show. That's facebook.com/onthemedia. I'm Bob Garfield, and thanks for listening.